Everything we do is music.
Acoustic space. Boundless, directionless, horizonless.
36.
20.
20.
20.
Welcome to 3620, podcasting from the basement of 3620 Walnut Street by the doctoral students at the Annenberg School for Communication here at the University of Pennsylvania. I'm your host, Deborah Loy, and this week we bring you a piece by Nicholas Gilowitz about the purpose of communication studies and scholarship. It is called, What is Communication For? Hope you enjoy.
Part 1, Introduction. Telos, the classical Greek concept, refers to the purpose of things, to their aims and ends. The telos of higher education in general has been questioned, with enormous pressure put on moving it towards a transactional, vocational model. In communications, we see this too. Should we prepare our undergraduates, and graduates for that matter, for futures in administrative research? Should we continue our critical tradition, despite the discomfort non-academic employers have voiced about it? That is to ask, what is communications for? It's a scary question, and one that troubles some influential people in our field. Larry Gross is past president of the International Communication Association and a vice dean at University of Southern California. He published an article on the topic in the Journal of Communications in 2012. In it, he wrote that, quote, we need to insist on our importance to both liberal arts and pre-professional education, and that, quote, communication studies can rightfully claim a central role not only in the basic general education of an informed citizenry, but also in understanding and clarifying many of the central challenges of a rapidly changing world. Last summer also saw a bit of a spat on the website Inside Higher Ed. Ernest J. Wilson III, the dean of the Annenberg School for Communication at USC, bemoaned what he found to be the lack of common methods and theories in the discipline, a firm sense of its intellectual history and grounding, and its disconnection from communities of practice. Wilson wrote, quote, the field suffers from a kind of academic log-rolling behavior which feeds the reification of silos in the field. So, let's roll some logs. Part 2. Research Questions. A week after Ernest Wilson's critique in Inside Higher Ed, the executive director of the National Communication Association, Nancy Kidd, and NCA's associate director for academic and professional affairs, Trevor Perry Giles, fired back on the same publication. In their critique of Wilson, they offered what they called, quote, a corrective vision of the discipline. And repeating the summary is quite worthwhile. They wrote, rooted firmly in the classical imperative of understanding the power of speech to sway public audiences, and in the contemporary imperative of understanding the power of mediated messages to move millions, communication scholars are engaged in rigorous, sustained research that appreciates the role and influence of communication across all aspects of public and private life. Free of a stultifying adherence to methodological or theoretical orthodoxies, communication scholars and teachers embrace the ubiquity of communication and work to explain, understand, and analyze it. So even while Kidd and Perry Giles critique Wilson, Wilson is surely right about one thing. The discipline often suffers from siloing. And if we follow the corrective vision of the discipline just offered, perhaps even while we suffer from siloing, we have a wealth, perhaps all, of the silos. So I spoke with three Annenberg students and asked them first, what communications is for? Second, if communications might be for everything, then what does that get us? And where, in this world comprising all the silos, they themselves might fit?
Communications
Imagination is the only way. Part 3, Results. Interview 1.
What communications as a discipline affords me, and I would also say more media studies because that's sort of where I place myself in the field of communications, is a real consideration of how mediated technology changes sociality, and not in a sort of a technologically determinist way, but in a complicated and nuanced way. I think looking at religious groups is a particularly interesting place to do that because religious groups are focused on community and community building.
Karina Laughlin studies religious uses of the internet, focusing on American evangelicals. I asked her to imagine her future career in communications.
That is a really terrifying question. Thank you for that. It's really scary. Well, I'm interested in a few different things that will, I guess, hopefully make me marketable. I'm not sure. I'm very interested in ethnography and ethnographic methods. I'm also interested in how film and other like multimedia scholarship might function in the academy in the future, and how we can make multimedia scholarship viable in the academy. The question that'll probably be more central to my dissertation will be about how religious group or how evangelical Christians see the mediated world. They're a particularly interesting group because they tend to be, unlike many other religious organizations, they tend to be very enthusiastic about media. They tend to see it as a really useful tool, and they have fewer, I guess, hang-ups, you would say, about the use of media than some other religious groups. So because of that, they're early adopters of media, and they tend to do, I think, really interesting things with it and have really interesting ideas about it. So I'm interested in the American evangelical belief in media and maybe how that's transforming different spaces on the internet and how it's sort of shaping different technological changes taking place right now.
Could you give me some specific examples of what or how evangelicals are working with new media?
There's a lot of different things I could say. I mean, like I said before, the most interesting thing to me is not even what they're doing, but what they're thinking about it and sort of the imagined space that the technology allows for. They're creating online churches. They're talking about a lot of different ways to do like baptism online and communion online. So they're really taking the medium and trying to push it as far as they can in and trying to translate trying to translate many of their practices into an online framework. Evangelicals are also really interesting because there's this whole, I'm calling it like an evangelical tech boom right now in evangelical culture.
So tell me a little bit more about the imagined space. How is it different for them than for sort of the like early cyber utopians of thinking about what the internet is or is for or the social role that it could play?
In some ways, it's not all that different. It's very similar. In my experience, I think evangelicals tend to have an understanding of the internet as a democratic space. They also tend to see the medium as a way to just completely do away with the category of space. Space no longer matters. And for evangelical missionaries and most religious missionaries, geography has always been a really limiting factor. And so with the internet, there's this sort of belief that we can just do away with that altogether. And so there's all these stories or testimonials of people who are in India and stumble upon a website. So it's for them a really powerful way to erase the category of space.
Interview 2.
My name is Natasha Yazbek. I'm a second year.
Natasha Yazbek's experience of Annenberg and the discipline of communications has been one of disruption and fairly radical professional adjustment. So why did you leave? What brought you to the U.S. and brought you to Annenberg?
The last time I came out of Syria, I was a little bit tired and I needed a break for multiple reasons from journalism, including some of the things that I'm still slightly critical of in the way that journalism works today. And I thought that this was a good way of remaining engaged in the same issues from a different perspective. It would give me a few years away from the field to regroup and think more in depth. And so I came.
I mean, one thing that we've talked about off and on is the struggle to adjust to academic life from doing something quite different previously. So can you talk a little bit about that, the ways in which you feel you're successfully making that, what you're struggling with, what about that transition, or even if you want to go back to working as a journalist, the hiatus is like?
I don't know what I'm going to do after this, right? Like a lot of other people. On the most basic level, the biggest transition or struggle for me is that I never realized before that I've never actually had an office job. I had an office, I had a newsroom, but I was a reporter, so I was most of the time not in the office. And even when I was, you don't really have a boss as a journalist. You know, you have an editor. The terms of engagement with your editor are very, very different than the terms of engagement with a professor or an academic advisor. Not better. They're just different. It's a different form of working. So the first struggle for me has been I live indoors, right? And most of my work is indoors. It's freezing out. I can't go outside. Yeah, I'm confined. And that's new. And I don't like it, to be honest. Now, I know this changes with the dissertation phase, which I'm very much looking forward to. So that's been a struggle. The second struggle is, and I know that this is a struggle that is not unique to our field, how publicly engaged is academia really, right? That's up for debate. How publicly engaged is journalism? I mean, who does it speak to and who does it speak for? And a lot of the same issues, right? So those issues haven't gone away. I thought they would be resolved here, but they're not, so...
By here, do you mean academic work or Annenberg? More specifically, which place and why did you think that they would get resolved better here?
Well, as a journalist, you have understandably rules, right? 600 words, your deadline's 2 hours away. You can't be that critical. And you really, really lose a lot of nuance and context for the sake of a story. So, you know, I thought coming here, it's long form. You know, you have all this time to be critical. And you do, but you give up something for that too, which is proximity to the field.
What do you mean by proximity to the field? Because it feels like some of the things that you're interested in studying would involve substantial field work. You could go and work with stringers or with people, I mean, whether or not you go back into the reporting field yourself, but the research components of it could involve some aspects of that.
Well, and as I'm saying this, I realize that the same can be said again for a journalist. You live in the first world. You visit the field, and you come back to the first world. And that's fine. Arguably, journalists do the same, right? Even in the worst of places, where do you go? You go back and you live in Beirut in your, you know, nice little pad in Jemesi. It's just a different way of working. The deadlines are different. The physicality of it is different. Journalism, a lot of it is, depending on what kind you do, it's sensory relationship to the events around you. I saw, I smelled, I heard. And it's not the same here, and that's fine, right? Because what you gain here is something different. It's just been a change.
I feel like... asking you, like, my therapist, when she's like, how are you doing this week? And I'm like, oh, I'm doing okay. I feel like the, like, it's fine is, like, my response to, like, oh, things are okay.
What do you mean when you say I'm fine? Because I say I'm fine all the time.
I mean, it's sort of like a default statement slash illusion.
So it's a mask.
Well, both, because things are fine and are not fine. The question, I guess, is for the academic work and for the communications field, which are fine and aren't fine for you?
Communications is great, right? I didn't apply to journalism schools. I specifically applied to communication programs because it's a new enough field that there's a lot of flexibility there. There's a lot of elbow room, and it's pointed towards the future rather than stuck in a certain point of time, which I like a lot. Journalism plays a central role in it, which I like a lot. There's a larger question of, and this has been debated to death, right? What is the role of the academic? What is the role of scholarship? Who is it helping? I don't know, honestly. I don't know. Even if you're as public and intellectual as one can be, I still don't know how much you're helping and who are you helping. What do you mean by help? By the same token, you know, are aid workers helping? Is United Nations helping? Is journalism helping? There's no answer to any of these. I think that's been the hardest lesson is that there will be no answers, no matter how much you critically reflect on issues.
How different is that from journalistic practice?
There are answers in journalism, right? There are clear answers. Who, what, where, when. Those you can answer. The how is a little bit murkier and the why is a little bit murkier, and you don't necessarily need to address those in news coverage, and I was a news girl. You go to bed at the end of the day, if you go to bed. You know, it's an exciting life. Something in you feels good. You feel excited. And also there's the lure of like having your name in these major publications. That's great. Never underestimate the ego of someone who thinks they can be a journalist. I it might be the same with academia. I don't know. You can tell me. But the sense of engagement is much more immediate, right? You live with the rebels. It's a good feeling. How much are you actually doing That's debatable, right? But it's a feel-good profession, I think. And that bothered me a little bit at the end. You know, I feel great. What has changed? Nothing. It's getting worse. So.
Interview 3. In his Journal of Communication article, Larry Gross called for communication scholars to remember our field's historic engagement with the wider world, that is, with non-academic audiences. Gross wrote, quote, "We're all familiar with the condescension, if not contempt, with which many academics view colleagues who address lay audiences rather than scholarly peers and graduate students. And this remains a concern for those of us plotting out our futures." Second-year doctoral student, Eleanor Marchant.
I feel very profoundly that whatever I do, I want it to be really engaged. And, you know, that's potentially a dirty word for academics a lot of times, right? But it's of value to, okay, if as an academic we're spending all of this time learning these things and studying these things, if it doesn't somehow then contribute back to society, and there's many, many different ways that that could be, I've failed to see for me the purpose, right? So if other people have value in that, that's wonderful. But I would be very unsatisfied if the work that I do wasn't able to at least be in conversation with people in other disciplines and with people outside of academics, right? And I very much mean like a two-way conversation, right? I want to be in a space, if I stay in academics, where, you know, I'm talking with development practitioners, I'm talking with people that are running startups, you know, I'm really constantly seeing what kind of research is useful for them, what kind of information is useful for me. It's a back and forth, and I think that's a really important way for growing knowledge.
So to be like CNN, good or bad? I mean, that's a sort of disciplinary question, right? Like, is it good that communications is that accommodating? I mean, because you and I, for example, do very different research. I do mostly historical, a lot of archival stuff, a lot of things with memory studies, and some digital media theory stuff adjunct to that. You're doing things that are also that are much more related to current lived experience internationally. Like, what do we share?
Well, so I think I'm gonna answer it in two parts. One is the sharing question. I mean, I think what we have in common is this really interest in the way in which communications as a tool or as how people engage with one another, you know, how that helps to understand the world and how it helps to understand people. And we're looking at different aspects of that, right? But I think that commonality is a thread throughout everyone that studies communications, whether it's journalism or health communications, you know, that we see something important for humanity, which is such a grandiose way of putting it. But, you know, in that ability to interact, right? I really feel like the interdisciplinarity of communications is an asset. I know that's a widely debatable kind of topic. And sometimes it's really frustrating. You know, sometimes it's frustrating being in a department where you feel like people don't understand one another. But I genuinely feel like I have the most potential in myself for intellectual growth when I am constantly being challenged by people who have a different perspective from my own, from people who have a different background that I'm learning from these people. And I feel like being in a department that's as interdisciplinary and as diverse as this, you know, I'm constantly getting exposed to those kind of things that everyone else, you know, is bringing to the table. And I feel like that keeps my own work fresh.
There's a more normative aspect to the research that you do, I think. And I hope you talk about that a little bit.
I feel like I have to defend that because often it's not considered a good thing to be an academic that might have that kind of perspective. Because I had this background in media development, you know, I was really interested in the role that communications and increasingly the role that advancements in technology for communications have in facilitating some kind of development. I try very hard for that to not be me imposing my idea of what is developed on somebody else. That's why I really ended up adopting a kind of ethnographic anthropological approach, which is very in opposition to political science where I started in some ways. But for me, it really felt like it was a better reflection. I'm interested in what helps facilitate development that is in the interest and that's desired by people in a particular community. And in order to do that, you need to really understand how they see the world, how they see themselves, how they understand these particular pieces of technology, right? So my research at the moment focuses on what are technology incubators, so like a small business incubator. There's obviously lots of these in Silicon Valley, but there's been a real explosion of them across Africa. My previous professional work had mostly been in Kenya, so my work now focuses in Kenya because I feel like that experience is important. I spend a lot of time with people in the startups there at the office where they're trying to grow what I have been calling locally generated technology. It's hugely important to me because I think it's the role that this kind of technology that is generated by people in a local community, the role that that might play in how they choose to develop in the future. You know, there's potential there, right? And I really want to understand that.
Part 4, limitations. First, a confession. I hate writing like this. The hardest paper to complete was my first year methods class, which is a report on an experiment. Not my métier, not my writing style, and so I thought I'd engage in a bit of parodic structure here. So this podcast had only 3 interviews, and it's not generalizable, because it came from a convenient sample. Karina and Elle responded to my email call for interviews and were available. Natasha agreed through snowballing. Elle mentioned it to her, and Natasha said she was interested, and she happened to be available. And it's not representative of the full array of research topics and approaches at the Annenberg School. Particularly, you'll notice that there are no political communication or health communication interviewees here. In a world of silos, I've stolen from but only a few. Part 5, conclusions. For as much as the critique of critical and cultural scholarship can suggest it doesn't engage with the quote-unquote real world, my 3 interviewees all expressed a great deal of concern with praxis, how our studies relate to and affect lived life. The public impact of the work is a major concern for them. But I don't want to derive conclusions about communication scholarship not fully supported by my evidence. For my parodic structure is engaged in a great deal of subjectification. Elle, Karina, and Natasha, all of whom I like and whose work I respect, are reduced in some ways here to their words. And words are in many ways all we really have as scholars. How well we abstract our research can affect whether we're invited to conferences. How well we present our arguments and presentations can get us invited to future talks or to jobs. How well we write affects how well our articles are received. And for all our concern with the world around us, in many ways, our work can come down to soundbites. Can I defend or define my dissertation project in 30 seconds or fewer for a famous scholar in my subfield? So what is communication study for? I'm still not fully sure, but at least the exchange of words and trying to figure out how to understand them, and even that sounds terrible. That sounds terrible. I don't want to even say or record that, but it's too late. And I guess I have to be okay with that. And so, I'll reduce myself to words as well. For 3620, I'm Nicholas Gilowitz.
The views expressed on this podcast are those of its producers and do not represent the Annenberg School for Communication, its faculty, staff, or student body. The 3620 podcast is licensed under a Creative Commons Attribution Non-Commercial Share-Alike International 3.0 license. That means you can remix, repost, or recycle any of the content as long as you aren't making money, you don't change the credits, and you share it under the same license.